Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Our next guest is Anna Motz, an acclaimed forensic psychotherapist who looks at women who commit extreme acts of violence and cruelty and at the underlying oppression and abuse often at the heart of these crimes. Women can be murderers and child abusers. They can commit acts of extreme and sadistic brutality. And those who do are outcasts from society and from womanhood itself. They are seen as monsters and angels of death and must be kept at a safe distance. Anna Motz explores in depth the shockingly underexamined psychological underpinnings of female violence. Far from the heartless and inhuman monsters we might believe them to be, these women are often victims of a culture of violence and emotional trauma. And the name of the book is If Love Could Kill, The Myths and Truths of Women Who Commit Violence. And we welcome Anna Motz to the Roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
What brought you to the subject, a very specific subject?
Well, I was working in forensic services, so basically people who committed crimes, committed offenses in the context of mental illness or psychological disturbance. And what I began to notice was that the women who committed crimes did so in quite a different way from the men and were often overlooked in these systems really designed for men. So I became increasingly interested in wanting to understand what had led these women into committing acts of violence and how, most importantly, really, how could I help them to break out of those patterns of very destructive behavior?
Give us a sense of what you mean by overlooked.
Yes, that's a really important question. So I think the women were sometimes hyper-visible as criminals. So a mother, for example, who committed the most unimaginable tragic crime of killing her own child, perhaps in the throes of a delusion, would be very well known as a violent woman, maybe even seen as someone who was totally evil or crazy, but not really seen in her full complexity, not seen in terms of the history of her trauma or the social context in which she had found herself. So in systems, like I say, that were designed for men, many of the treatment programs were around offending behavior programs, very much modeled and normed on male offenders, but not looking at the particular issues that so many of the women who end up in secure psychiatric hospital or criminal justice settings have experienced, have lived through and suffered. So there was a sense in which they were invisible as women, as whole people, as previously damaged and hurt and neglected children, but hyper-visible as offenders.
So that idea of the violence being preceded by abuse and a harrowing experience or a dysfunctional relationship often seems to be the commonality.
Absolutely. And of course, not in every case has there been a very specific form of trauma. There are, and conversely, people who have experienced abuse, neglect, and trauma do not necessarily go on to commit violence. But if I would look, and the psychological literature examines the histories of so many of the women in the criminal justice system, and particularly those I see as a psychologist, we find really significant histories of trauma, abuse, neglect, deprivation as well. And the trauma doesn't just have to be interpersonal in terms of psychological, physical, emotional abuse. It could also be societal abuse, so racial discrimination. The studies around adverse childhood experiences show that, you know, being in poverty, that kind of social economic deprivation is also a risk factor for other of these adverse experiences. So it's a very sad trajectory, really, that one risk factor increases the likelihood of another adverse experience. So there isn't just one trauma generally in the lives of these women I work with and try to help. There's a complex set of traumatic experiences building on each other. And then there can be this explosion or crescendo into a violent act which then leads the woman into an institution of one form or another.
In your experience, and I realize all situations are different, but you talk in the book about a lightning rod of what causes that explosion, of the emotional pressures that lead women to a violent act.
Absolutely. So there can be, and this is something we see in cases where traditionally it would be called a battered woman, so a battered woman who kills, so there can be a very slow burn. So the ability to endure abuse over a series of years, and then there's a moment where something just snaps, that lightning rod explosion. And it can be a sudden realization that there is no escape, or a fear, as I describe in the case of Lillian, that the woman's own child or any possibility of a different kind of life is about to be extinguished. So it feels like a life or death struggle. In other cases, there can be a momentary loss of control. And when women harm infants, sometimes there's that kind of explosive rage that just has built up for months of sleep deprivation, depression, sometimes social circumstances that are pretty unbearable, an abusive partner, maybe even drugs or alcohol. But then there's that lightning rod flash of that this can no longer be endured, and the rage and the pain just breaks through.
You mention Lillian, a couple of the other women that you profile in the book. I'm interested in Grace. This is a mother who really purposefully is inflicting a reaction in her daughter who's only 5 or 6 years old.
Correct. Yes. So Grace is suffering from or experiencing what we would call Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And that is this very particular form of disturbance and child abuse, effectively, whereby a caregiver, generally a mother, is using that child in order to gain attention, medical attention for her child. But really, that gives her center stage in a drama. Obviously, that's been around a lot lately with the release of Gypsy Rose Blanchard from jail, herself a woman who experienced a mother with this kind of incredible level of disturbance, so that the mother is using the child in order to get her own needs met in a way that not only inflicts pain and causes sometimes fatal harm to a child, but also is a kind of abuse of the medical profession itself. Because unnecessary medical treatments and interventions are performed. So, doctors, nurses, other healthcare professionals are also kind of abused and tricked. So, it can be a very powerful, violent, ongoing act, which, or series of acts, which is also really difficult to uncover.
So, where does, when a breakthrough happens, how is that allowed in the sense of within the mind of where you have someone like Grace who is eventually able to acknowledge their own pathologies? And as you said, there's a lot of masking going on. So, what's the eventual breakthrough that what leads to that?
That in cases like Grace's is a long, slow process. Although our studies have shown that actually some of the Munchausen syndrome parents are report a sense of relief where they're finally caught, because there's a part of them that knows what they're doing is wrong, while another part of them is quite addicted to this behavior. But in the case of someone like Grace, acknowledgement is only gradual. And I would say, even when she is able to acknowledge some of the harm she's done, it's not a full acknowledgement of all the ways in which she's deceived and lied, but enough for her to say, I did wrong. I take responsibility for what I've done. And some insight or understanding about what led her to do that. And oftentimes that involves her tracing her own history in a therapeutic relationship, where she sees how, for her as a child, she may have been treated in this way by a mother or a caregiver, or she may just have, like in Grace's case, associated medical care with attention, love, and affection. because for Grace, she was the little angel who had saved her mother when she had an epileptic fit. And she'd been quite a neglected and deprived little girl in many ways, but this central experience in her life gave her a sense of real well-being and recognition. And she never really got over that until, of course, many years later, where she was able to work therapeutically with me. And we also brought her husband into the treatment. So, but there were still areas where she couldn't quite accept fully what she had done. And I think that's a very common thing, that there can be 90% acknowledgement, but still a little bit that's holding back.
Anna Motz is our guest. The name of the new book is If Love Could Kill, The Myths and Truths of Women Who Commit Violence. You look at that as you were saying in the case of Grace, that it is very much a slow process. Sapphire is also someone that you portray in the book and had a traumatic childhood, abused her own children, but then was able to regulate those emotions after some 14 months of therapy, which in the grand scheme of things seems to me to be a pretty quick turnaround.
I think that's right. I think 14 months may sound like a long time to have someone in treatment, but given that there are three lives at stake, there were two young sons and Sapphire herself. And what was so impressive about someone like Sapphire is that exactly in that lightning rod kind of way we talked about earlier, she had lost control at various moments and actually physically harmed her little boys, but had a real sense immediately of having done wrong and taken them for care, was wanting help, wanted to stop this. And with so I didn't just work in isolation in cases like this where there are child safeguarding and protection issues. Social services, child protective services are right there alongside. So I wouldn't have the full kind of confidentiality I would as a psychotherapist in another situation. I mean, if Sapphire had done something that put her children at risk, she knew I would have to report that. So it's a kind of modified confidentiality, but that works because she knows we're all on the side of her being the best, safest mother she could possibly be. And that's what she aimed for too. So with her being able to trace back her own experiences of being, her own mothering and fathering, not being able to allow her to express sadness, aggression, fear in any kind of way that could teach her how to regulate her feelings, led to her enacting those same kinds of, poor parenting practices with her children, only worse because she at times had a partner who used drugs and alcohol, and she would party, and then she would lose any residual bit of control. But with her being able to really face what she'd done, which I would say she could do almost entirely, she really owned up to what she had done and felt very remorseful, guilty, ashamed of how she had harmed these boys. And even at the beginning of the work, I could see that she had such a capacity to love and see these children that it became possible to work with her quite quickly to really establish that therapeutic rapport. And seeing her blossom and seeing the children blossom, the reports from the social workers and teachers at school and other health professionals was just incredibly rewarding, and to my mind, one of the most important pieces of work, any forensic psychotherapist can accomplish to help parents and help the children remain with those parents.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier where you were talking about some of your patients and then you were clear to say, though not all, could have a sense of reform when there was appropriate support. At what point, or is there a point for sure where you know that support, that therapy is not going to work, that there's something there that is encumbering the treatment and for there to be some sort of reform within that woman.
I think that's an essential point to bear in mind. And if I didn't notice and acknowledge when therapy was simply not going to be effective in helping someone face the dangers within them, I would be irresponsible. So yes. And in the book, I describe a woman who sexually abused children, Amber, and she is someone where very sadly, after a trial period of therapy, it became clear that she was so wedded to her own victim status, she couldn't see, she couldn't acknowledge her own perpetration. And that meant she couldn't begin to explore what had led her to do harm, because she continued either to deny it or to blame the victims. And until she was able to take that first step of acknowledging some responsibility for the harm she'd caused, I think it was the shame of being a woman who's sexually abused, which is still highly stigmatized and considered rare, inhuman, unacceptable. That shame stopped her, but there was also such a resistance in her to acknowledging the excitement she'd got from that abuse. And she remained also in a relationship with a man with whom she had shared indecent images of children. At the moment, I work with some women who have harmed children, and I encounter similar defenses that mean they can only see themselves as a victim. And even though tragically those children may have died, they still blame those children as though they somehow deserved punishment, but also deny their own roles in creating that fatal harm. And in those cases, sadly, I have to put my hands on my heart and say reform is simply not possible. That's the minority of cases, thankfully, but absolutely, it's something to bear in mind.
And there isn't a link, at least it was my sense in the reading, that there isn't a link that would say that this person's experience was their traumatic childhood was, not that I'm ranking this in any way, but was worse than another person that would make them unable. That it doesn't have to be the circumstance, it can be the barriers that they put up.
Absolutely. So you can have two siblings, can't you? And one of them can go on to be someone I work with in a criminal justice setting, in a secure hospital or in a prison, and their sibling may, with the same upbringing, clearly parents may have related to them a bit differently, but fundamentally similar circumstances, and they will not go on to commit those crimes. And sometimes there are cases, and this has happened quite explosively in the headlines in the UK, where teenagers kill. And I've worked with many young women who have killed or sadistically tortured others in the context of a couple. And I firmly believe that had they not formed that kind of toxic coupling with another person, they on their own would not have gone on to commit such an awful act of cruelty. So there are a whole series of factors that lead to these explosive acts of violence. And you're quite right. One person's traumatic history doesn't mean they will certainly go on to commit that offense. And somebody else's less, obviously, horrific experience may be interpreted by them in such a way, and other social factors may interfere, who they happen to meet, whether they get into the dark web, drugs and alcohol, gangs where extreme violence is normalized, or couples in a couple where one person actually reinforces the distorted and perverse imaginings of another.
So let me end with this, which is a big question, no doubt about it. It is, in this country, in the United States, we see this stunning number of school shootings and mass shootings, and it's very rare, if not at all, to be a woman. And I'm, what do we take from things like that, of the violent acts that we see and how they're ultimately perpetrated, tells us about the gender divide when it comes to explosive acts of violence?
Yes, I mean, you're quite right. There was recently a case of a female shooter, a serial shooter in this way, but it is extremely rare. I mean, one of my thesis in the book, one of my main points is that women are still not as violent as men, and that when they are violent, it isn't generally in the public arena. So I know that there's been a rise in female terrorism. However, they're still in the minority. Most of the crimes that are committed by women, most of the violent acts, occur in the domestic private sphere. And some of that violence, which we haven't had time to talk about, is actually extreme acts of self-harm, violence against their own bodies, but also violence against children and their intimate partners. And female violence tends often to be disguised, go underground. The veneer of femininity, sentimental ideas about what women can and can't and won't do, cover up actually the capacity and propensity for acts of extreme violence. But generally not, women are generally not a risk to the public in the way that men are, and it is still gendered.
The name of the book is If Love Could Kill, The Myths and Truths of Women Who Commit Violence. The book is published by Knopf. Anna Motz, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Be well. Thanks so much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.